A big welcome to the Mindfield podcast with your hosts, Kiri and Alexi. For those who haven't joined us before, welcome and thank you for taking the time to listen. With quarantine and lockdown, new podcasts are popping up on a daily basis as the boredom begins to set in, and we do appreciate the choice that you have, so thank you for tuning in to us. Now, the aim of the podcast is very simple. We are here to try and open up conversations around mental health, try and have some fun along the way. We interview all sorts of guests, and they include the famous and the not so famous. We're now well into season two, and the plan is for much more of the same. Season one saw us host professional sportsmen, psychiatrists, entrepreneurs, artists, musicians, as well as straightforward, everyday people. They all offer their unique take on what mental health is to them, how they've overcome problems in the past, and how they've led happy and successful lives, even whilst battling their inner demons. They tell us how they have navigated their very own minefields. Today, I'm pretty excited to say that we're welcoming Vernon Sankey and Katie Lockwood, the authors of The Way, Finding Peace in Turbulent Times, a highly topical subject considering what the world is going through right now. Who better, we thought, than to invite guests that have pretty much written the blueprint for how to cope in these troubling times. Now, The Way is Vernon's second book. He released The Stairway to Happiness in 2018. But before releasing these books, Vernon led a highly successful business career, serving as CEO, chairman, and board member of companies such as Reckitt Benckiser, Pearson, Taylor Woodrow, Gala Group, and Atos. It's a bit of a who's who and list of large multinational businesses across the UK and Europe. And then in 1999, he co-founded a coaching and mentoring company, where he developed his knowledge of cognitive psychology to help mentor business executives as well as people in all walks of life. Then there's Katie. She comes from a slightly different background. After starting her career in media, Katie studied neuro-linguistic programming before going on to study philosophy at the London School of Economics. During the past decade, she has analysed and studied many philosophical and metaphysical principles, including the universal laws, the Hermetica, and she's also well-versed in spiritual practices, including meditation. Her knowledge of cognitive psychology, philosophy, and spirituality has enabled her to coach and teach at the very highest level. We also have Alex Gray, who's currently studying to become a psychotherapist, who kindly put us all together. Katie, Vernon, a big welcome to the Mindful podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having us.
No problem. I have to say, I love the book. I read it in a matter of days over the weekend, partly due to how quickly we set this all up, but also due because it's a really engrossing read. And under normal circumstances, I would go as far as saying it was extremely enlightening and very, very useful. But given the current worldwide situation, it is suddenly even more relevant. Now, I wanted to try and summarize it, and I thought with the time that we have, I won't do it justice. But we do obviously want it to form the basis of our chat. So instead, I want to read, mainly for the benefit of our listeners, I'm sure you know this passage very well, but I want to read a quote from the introduction. And before I do, it's probably worth pointing out to our listeners and those subscribers that this was written and published, I think, almost 18 months before coronavirus or COVID-19 entered our everyday language. Now, it's reasonably long, so please do bear with me, but I assure you it's worth it. The Way to Finding Peace in Turbulent Times is intended to help readers understand how negative thoughts, fears, and anxieties arise and how to deal with them. The way we think as individuals affects the collective mind and determines the fate of the world itself. Unless we change the way we think individually and collectively, nothing will change. The world will continue down an increasingly dangerous and calamitous path. This is not idle fear-mongering, but the conclusion of many erudite thinkers, scientists, and philosophers. Now, you then go on to quote Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal. The public is still in denial about two kinds of threats: harm that we're causing collectively to the biosphere, and threats that stem from the greater vulnerability of our interconnected world to error or to terror induced by individuals or small groups. Moreover, what's new in this century is that a catastrophe will resonate globally. In our networked world, there would be nowhere to hide from economic collapse, a pandemic, or a collapse in global food supplies. In such a predicament, it is collective intelligence that would be crucial. So that there is, hopefully, a reasonably apt piece for what we're going to talk to, Vernon, Katie. I wanted to start by saying you're two very different people with quite clearly different backgrounds. And I'm interested in how you two came to meet and decide that The Way was the book that you wanted to write.
Katie, you start.
I met Vernon when he had the Redco business. And I think I was actually in a gym. And I'd be on the gym and he'd put these cognitive dissonance exercises in front of me and asked me if I understand it. And I was like, yes, I understand this. And then, because I was studying psychology, I was doing NLP, I was doing, I was learning the spiritual aspect. And that was the time where Vernon was doing the first book, which was Stairway to Happiness. And I'd read through some of the writing that he'd already put into this, which were the four initial steps, but I felt there was more to add to it. So I sort of introduced him to the universal laws and the metaphysical side and the spiritual side of it. And yeah, and then we kind of aligned in this understanding. So it's quite a broad perspective, and it's kind of this merge of science and spirituality, but it's a really good interweaving of kind of both of our perspectives.
And it all started in the gym. I love it. It's not where I think most of these books come from, but
makes sense. Well, that is actually absolutely right. Yes, it started in the gym, and we have a mutual friend who had spoken to each of us, and she said, you should really talk to each other. And so as it happened, I had a copy of Festinger's Law of Cognitive Dissonance. It's a nice paper. And so I stuck it in front of Katie, and thinking, well, this is going to get torn up and thrown away. But quite on the contrary, she was asking very, very good questions. And it was quite clear that not only did she have a good understanding of everything we were trying to do, in many respects, she was much further advanced than my own thinking. So as she said, the first book has five sections, but Stairway to Happiness has five different steps. And the last step wasn't going to be in the book until we got together. And then I realized that it wasn't complete without an additional step. So the last step is called the Happiness of Harmony. And that brings us into a much more spiritual environment. And then she said, well, you should read this, you should read that, you should read the other. And so I spent a great deal of time researching and really got into this in a very big way. And everything started to come together. So a lot of the practices and the philosophical knowledge that I had before was brought together by this and took a leap forward. And it's at that point we decided, well, you know, we really have something together that we can put in a new book, which in some ways is a sort of sequel to The Stairway to Happiness, because the last part of The Stairway to Happiness brings you into the concepts of the way. And so we decided we'd write the way and try and use it as widely as we possibly can in order to change the way people think about the world, about what they're doing. And we realized that all the issues that we currently have are related to an erroneous way of thinking. And therefore, if we can find a way to allow people to think somewhat differently and to find a way in which they can feel that rather than just intellectualize it, that's how we'll make a change. Otherwise, we will simply be rearranging the deck chairs on a Titanic. And we've tried all kinds of different systems. The world has tried all kinds of different systems, none of which have actually made any difference at all. And that's because the thinking hasn't actually changed. And so that's where we are with the way. The way is in order to enable people to think differently. And by thinking differently, not only can we collectively create a better world, but actually the stress levels immediately reduce, because our stress levels are entirely related to the way we're thinking.
No, I think that's spot on. In amongst all of this, obviously journalists are in a boom time for writing articles on what the future's looking like and what the next steps are. And I've lost count of the number of articles that I've read that have said, well, does capitalism need to change? Or are we moving into a new stage of liberalism? Or is the more dictatorial regime, such as the Chinese or the South Koreans, or is that the way to go? And I think you're spot on. It's sort of missing the point. You mentioned stress there, and in the book you say that the greatest contributor to bad health in the world, you know, forget exercise and all that, is stress. You know, that stress, the world is experiencing an epidemic of stress. Now, why are people so stressed? I mean, even forgetting about COVID-19 for a little bit, and maybe we'll get onto that later. Why is there an epidemic of stress?
You go first, Katie.
Well, I think it's just the way that we're living now. We're living very noisy, busy lives, and there's so much to do that we don't have time just to stop. And, you know, many people don't meditate. They don't use that time of stillness just to reflect on yourself. I just think we're really sort of consumed with so much external stress that we don't know how to manage it. And that's the problem, is that if we don't understand these tools within ourselves, then we'll end up being controlled by external influences rather than controlling ourselves. So when you look at something like COVID-19 and how that's transpired, then we look at how we are responding to this, whether it's from fear or it's from love, and whether we're collaborating, whether we're helping people, or whether we are, you know, just in fear and we don't know how we're going to interact or how we're going to respond. So it's all about our response and our emotional intelligence and how we can deal with these things effectively. But yeah, you can see how, you know, if you look at even, for instance, with children now, they've got so many pressures, whether it's social media, whether it's to conform to certain parts of society and how that's pushing us forward, whether it's they need to do well in their exams. There's so many external pressures that it's just so hard for them just to be still. There's sort of lack of self-awareness as well that's present, I would say.
There's a fundamental flaw in the way we think, and it goes all the way through society. It starts with the education, starts even with parenting. But we think that we should be controlling our environment, right? So, and that starts from the belief that we're individuals, we're separate from the rest of the world. We are individuals, and we're held in this bag of skin. But the world is essentially inimical, it's alien, and we're intelligent beings in an unintelligent universe. And therefore, we have to survive at all costs. And to do that means we have to be selfish, we have to grasp resources, because otherwise, if we don't win, then we'll lose. So it's a win-lose situation. So our thinking is, we're in an alien world, we're different from everybody else, and therefore we have to fight to survive. And that thinking is entirely false, and it leads one to believe that means we have to control our environment. We have to control all the external things, and you can see that. So we are constantly looking for security, we're looking for safety, we're looking for certainty, we're looking to be able to predict the future, because our brains can look at the past and can do an assessment and say, oh, well, it means it's going to be like that. And we live for this certainty. All of that thinking is completely wrong, and it leads to high levels of stress, because it can't be done. It can't be done. So we're setting ourselves up to do something that simply isn't possible. And in order to keep trying to do this, we get better and better medicines in the assumption that sooner or later, medicine will be able to make us live forever. Well, it can't do that. So the doctors are bound to fail. Sooner or later, it's going to fall apart. We're looking to improve our technologies. We're looking to acquire more things, as if the acquisition of things is going to actually enable us to be sure of our environment. All of that thinking means it's going to be very stressful. And we do this with our children. We start off with our children, and we ask them to do things that are not possible. So we'll say to them, be spontaneous, be yourself, but at the same time, we want you to conform. Well, that is what's called a double bind. It's not possible. And all through life, we have these double binds. We have it in religion. You know, you must love your God with all your heart, with all your mind. Love is not something you order. Love happens. You don't order somebody to love. It can't be done. So, and you go through any ones of our philosophies, you'll find that the philosophies that start to dictate and insist and attach are all doomed to failure, and they will cause high levels of stress. So to change that thinking, we have to say, well, hold on. Why do you need to control? Why do you need to control? Why is there this obsession with understanding everything and having security, knowing that you can't? In fact, why can't you just live in a world and say, well, actually, the fact that I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow is actually rather an exciting thing. If we could really predict what was going to happen in great detail, in every detail for the next 20 years, what would we feel like? We would be bored to tears. If you could tell exactly what's going to happen, part of the beauty of life is the surprises, the awe, the beauty, the things you see around the corner all of a sudden, right? The fact that you don't know is one of the excitements of life. That's what life is, but it means you've got to change the way you think. So of course plan thing. It's perfectly sensible to plan, but don't be so attached to what you're planning that when something happens, you break down, you fall apart. And that's what's causing the stress. Now, with COVID-19, where nobody knows what's going to happen, we have no idea. And we're asking people an exit strategy. We need an exit strategy. You know, we need certainty of when are we going to come out of all this stuff, right? How can anybody possibly answer that question? We don't have any data. Instead of which, we should say, hold on, how can we manage the things we've got to manage? We've got to manage the economy. We've got to manage the stress levels. We've got to manage families who are stuck in high-rise fire. How can we do that in the most sensible way possible? And then we'll work our way through. And actually, the best leaders are the ones who've actually taken much more of that approach and said, we don't know, but this is what we can do right now. We don't know, and this is what we'll do next week.
Absolutely. There's something really refreshing about a politician or leader, and as you say, a good leader does this, of acknowledging that they do not know something and accepting that actually it's just part and parcel of what we're going through. This has never happened before. It may never happen again. And all these press conferences that happen now on a daily basis are full of journalist questions of almost asking the impossible, and no one really knows. And what you said as well in the first part of our answer on this, it's win-lose, is so, so relevant as well, because in every almost political arena now that we have, everything has become a zero-sum game. Whether it's America and China, they see it as, well, there's one winner and there's one loser, and that every interaction around the world in that sphere has to be a winner or a loser. And again, I find it infuriating. It's again, really nice. I think you put it far better than I ever could, in terms of how we need to see us far more as a collective and not necessarily as there are winners and losers in every single interaction in the world. Another thing that you talk about in the book that I quite enjoyed was this idea that we take ourselves and almost everything far too seriously, which I think probably leads into the stress. But I wondered, do we need to let go a little bit more to be able to de-stress and enjoy ourselves that little bit more?
Absolutely. Katie, go ahead.
We need to get them. Yes, we do need to let go.
Sorry, I kind of answered your question, but I know that you guys can add a lot more colour.
I think it is about the need to surrender, because we can't control so much. It's like with this virus, when you think about what we can control and what we can't control, when we can't control whether we get this virus, we can't control who gets the virus, we can't control how our body or our immune system is going to respond to the virus, we can't control the effect that it's going to have on financial markets, we can't control the response that the actions that others are going to have. So, but the only thing that we can control is ourselves, and we can control our thoughts, we can control our emotions, we can control our responses and our energetic frequencies. That's the only thing that we can control. So that's where we are able to stand in our own power. Letting go is definitely part of it.
It is. You see, I mean, Shakespeare said, you know, all the world's a stage. And yeah, we're all playing parts. Right? And the fact is, we are all playing parts. You know, persona means a mask in Greek, as you would know. Right? So it's a voice through. It's a voice through. So it's a mask. And we spend a lot of time trying to be who we're not, right? So we're playing games here. The world is actually essentially a stage. And we need to realize that that's true. And until we see who we are who we really are, and that we are playing this game, and it's a game, we take ourselves far too seriously. And you can see that. You can see people looking very stressed. I mean, their opinions are, they really believe these opinions. The idea that they could conceivably be wrong doesn't enter into their head, right? And so we're taking ourselves at a level of seriousness which is simply totally unwarranted, because we're projecting a sense of certainty and belief and, I know this and this is the answer to that, whereas everybody in the world knows that that isn't true. So you get that exposed with some of the politicians who are making out that they're experts in things, which they clearly aren't. Now, that's such an obvious thing. Everybody says no. But actually, we're all doing the same thing. We are all doing the same thing. And we need to realize that we're playing these games. Underneath all that, when we really get down to who we really are and find our true self, the true self is devoid of all this, because all these games are egotistical games. They're games to try and make ourselves more important, more influential, get re-voted. Whereas in fact, when you strip all that ego out, then you find the real human being. And the real human being is a good human being. All human beings, when all this conditioning and these clouds are taken away, are actually part of the same microcosm and has a level of consciousness which is much greater than it is when it's subject to all this conditioning. And then when collectively we find ourselves, that's when we can start making real changes. And unless we make those changes, we keep going down this very, very dangerous and increasingly dangerous road. So we have to make sure that our level of consciousness catches up with our technical capability. So we have a wonderful intellectual capability, but it isn't matched with our awareness of what we need to be as human beings.
Oh, absolutely. You've covered now sort of where the issues are and what the problems that we face as humanity and as individuals are. And I know that much of the book then goes on to address how we fix it and what are the solutions and what are the resolutions. And obviously it's a long, long old read and you're not going to be able to cover them all now, but just what can we do as individuals and as society and as humanity to sort of turn the corner and start being better?
We have to start to understand, we have to spend time thinking about who we really are. Who are you? Right. So the first key question is, who are you really? You're not your name. You're not your reputation. You're not the accolades. You're not your job. And a lot of things you're not. So who are you really, deep down at the deepest level? Who are you? And what is the authentic you? When we strip out all this rubbish, who are you really? Spend time. And then how can you get to your deepest sense? And that's where some exercises come into practice. You'll never find that without silence. You'll only find who you are and your connection to greater self in silence, in meditation. So on that one, I'll hand over now to Katie to say a little bit more about that, because she's very well versed in it.
When we say about looking inside yourself, sounds a bit weird sometimes, but it's more about personal reflection and personal awareness and how that corresponds to you. So when something happens, sometimes our direct response is to act in a certain way. But when we become self-aware, we start to challenge that. And then we can start to use things like breathing exercises, which allows us to pause in that moment, and therefore we can react differently, we can change that. So these are all sort of ideas of even things like gratitude, being just grateful for life. Sometimes we get lost with all this doing that we forget to just be. So it's the gratitude, and it's doing things just of acts of kindness, like what you can do to help others. So, just doing good deeds. So it's not just all about ourselves, which I think society is kind of dominating that very selfishness or almost sometimes narcissistic in some way. So just doing things for other people, being forgiving, because we're all in this boat together. We're all experiencing different emotions. So, forgiving each other and helping each other along. There's also, I think, at the moment, there's a need for transparency. It's really hard to discern the truth and to know what is actually happening, and we're being told the right things, because there's so much negative news at the moment. And obviously, if we're watching that and plugging into that all the time, it's going to deeply affect our well-being. So again, it's we have to value where we're putting our time and what we're allowing into our consciousness, so that we can say, you know, if that doesn't work for us, if that doesn't serve us, then we can, you know, use that time of value to do something positive, which will hopefully affect others positively as well. So that's how one of the laws of interconnection works. So just observing your thoughts, observing your own ego, being completely present and living in the now, accepting, embracing the new, and hopefully out of this there'll be new things that will happen which will be positive and, you know, affect the world in good vibrations. And whether it's environmentally or whether it's through mental health, I think there's going to be a lot of people who are consciously going to create really good projects out of, you know, of this time of deep reflection. So it's exciting, actually. I think it's a really exciting time.
Perhaps we could just add a practical exercise. Catch yourself complaining, blaming, or gossiping, right? Because all of those are negative, right? But we do a lot of it. So we're complaining about the government, we're complaining about the post hasn't arrived, we're complaining about the weather. But catch yourself doing that and then shift it. So catch yourself. So it means you're being self-aware. This is about really observing your own thoughts. And what am I saying here? And, oh, hello, it's a complaint, right? Change that complaint. Turn the negative into a positive. So anchor it as soon as, but you have to be aware. You have to spend time being self-aware, complaining. And when we blame everybody for everything except ourselves, of course. But catch yourself blaming, change it into a positive. And then gossiping is actually very, very dangerous, because the gossips always end up being quite negative. It's very rare that we gossip positively. So just on that, complain, blame, gossip, hold on to that. Another thing I think which is worth doing is as Katie was saying, is living in the now. Well, what does that mean, right? We spend a lot of the moment either thinking about what we did wrong or what went wrong before, which is in the past. So it's a memory trail. It's an illusion, but it's a memory trail. It's a thought. Or we worry about the future. That's another memory trap. That's another illusion. Because these are just thoughts. They don't exist, right? However, we crowd out the enjoyment of a present moment with reflections and fears about the past and anxieties about the future. Living in the now means actually taking huge enthusiasm and enjoyment with what's happening right this second. Right this second. So right this second, when I'm looking at you asking me the questions now, right this second, what's missing? Do you have any fears? Right this second, are there any fears at all? No.
Right. I was going to suggest that maybe losing Wi-Fi connection is one of the things I've currently got. Okay. I'll let you carry on. Other than that, no.
Right. Well, that may be. But I mean, that's come in and it's practical, but it is actually a fear, which may or may not happen, but it's a practical one. But if you're really focusing and concentrating on what's being said, and you're concentrating on the other person, which is incidentally probably the greatest sign of kindness that you can give to somebody else, is to actually listen openly to them. But if you're doing that, or doing anything, just walking in the garden, just enjoying walking in the garden, walking in nature, just doing that, you will find that these other thoughts disappear from your mind. And one of the greatest ways of reducing stress is by being in the present moment and not letting the thought, the fears, which are illusions, they don't exist. They do not exist, these thoughts, but we let them come into our mind because we're not focusing. So it's called single-pointedness in Buddhism. It's a single-pointedness, absolutely spending time properly looking at what we should. Have you got a police car going around now?
That was me. That's the benefits of living in. You asked me another thing that I'm fearing. It's the police car that's getting closer and closer.
Well, I think you'd be even more frightened if they came and knocking at the door.
Quite so.
I think it dramatized what you were saying, Vernon, so it went quite well.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, carry on.
Well, those are two practical things. I mean, there are a lot of practical exercises that are in the book, but which we're very happy to share. Because in the end, you've got to translate what is high philosophy at one end to actually very, very useful practical steps. I mean, just simply breathing. You know, I was talking to a guy who is helping prisoners to rehabilitate, and he's helping them just with breathing. So when they come to him, and some of them have got huge anger issues, and, you know, when somebody insults them, for them, that's life and death matter as far as they're concerned. And he says, hold on, just breathe before you do anything. So before you hit him back and go back into prison, just breathe 3 or 4 times. And then ask yourself, what should I do now? What's a sensible thing to do? Now, that's living in the now. That's an expression of living in now, which is extremely practical, and it saves him going back into prison. So, you know, all of these philosophies are actually translatable into very, very practical matters. And they'll help you to sleep. They'll help you everything else, because people wake up with thoughts about and fears about all kinds of things. They can't get back to sleep. I don't know how many people said to me they can't sleep, and then they can't get back to sleep. There's nothing easier to do than to get back to sleep if you live in the now.
Vernon, really useful. Sorry, Alexis.
Sorry, Vernon. I really like what you said about all you need is silence. My first experience of actually probably first properly getting into this mind and the now was doing a silent meditation retreat. I only did 3 days. I wanted to do 10, but my flights were already booked. It was a very random path. But what I want to ask you guys is, you know, on that, when did you first find, let's say, your silence or this idea? Did it come from a book? Did it come from an experience? And I guess, how can people find this, maybe reading your book, but also other things?
Well, I'll give you my answer is I got it from Katie, so I can...
Oh, that's lovely.
So Katie's got an answer now. Yeah.
So the ball has been passed straight over.
Love that.
But it is actually the truth. But I can then explain afterwards what I then subsequently did with it. But Katie's really the person to answer that question.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. For me, it's always been my life philosophy. I would say I'm quite introverted, so I'm very much, I like the stillness and very much in touch with nature. And it's funny actually, because I went for a walk yesterday and it's so beautiful around here because I live in the countryside, and you can hear all the birds, and you know, there's like flocks of there's deer everywhere. It's just so stunning because all the nature is all coming out because there's no noise of all the cars and the aeroplanes. And I bumped into a guy who works in the city, and he was saying he lives just around the corner of this beautiful countryside of lakes and everything else. He's never been to these places. They're 5 minutes away from his house because he's so used to doing the rat race of going to work, coming back, eat, sleep, you know, same again, repeat the same. So he's just like, I can't believe that this is here. You know, so he's really embracing that. So for me, I feel I'm really connected to nature. I feel my purpose and my path is to help other people to feel this connection. And it's changed my life in the fact that I think I kind of got lost in the system and realized how detrimental that can be to mental health, and realized that these tools really do help with understanding yourself better, but also just to live a much more wholesome life. So it's almost like going to the gym where you're learning to reprogram or train your body. You're using meditation as a tool to retrain your mind so that you can be much more effective in dealing with certain issues or circumstances. But also just to understand yourself so much more. It's a really nice connection of mind, body, soul. And I really believe that is so present in all of us. And when we talk about things like disease in the body, and actually it's a dis-ease within the body because the mind is disconnected from the body. So it will naturally show up in the body, but that's just where we are disconnected within ourselves. So yeah, it's something I do every day, and it's something that I feel very passionate that we should all try and do.
Yeah. It's lovely. I was asking myself a question the other day, whether more birds were outside because we had the same thing. We'd noticed the birds, or is it just that we were noticing them more? And I do think it's the noticing, it's the slowing down. You know, they've always been there. And you can do a very simple exercise, very similar to what you guys are talking about, which is listen to the birds, then almost forget about them. You don't hear them. They were still there, but they're just not within you, and you're not focusing on that. So I so get what you're saying, and it's so interesting. And I do almost feel on the bigger picture, like you guys have mentioned, that you know, this forceful slowdown could be you know, a ripple effect for a long time, like you said, Katie, with the projects that come out of it, from just people having more time, being a bit more inspired to, as you said, to slow down in the rat race. So thank you for that explanation. It was amazing.
You use the word notice, you see, because notice is awareness. Noticing is awareness. And we are noticing because we are hopefully becoming more aware. We have an opportunity now to be aware of things. And I'd go even further and say, notice the silence between sounds. So when you're listening to the birds, don't just listen to the sound of the birds. Notice the absence of sound between, because like that is actually who we are. All right. So we are, that is you, that is the universe. We are that. That is it. That's where it is. Right. So what you're doing is in silence. It's only in silence that you can do this. It's only when you are, what does silence mean? Silence means that you are in silence. And you're observing, you're watching, you're aware, you're finding who you are, you're looking at yourself, you're reconnecting. And yoga means union, it means the connection. And actually, the word religion, the correct explanation, religion is religiosi, which is to reconnect. Reconnect to what? So these wonderful, it doesn't matter what it is, it can be a church or temple, is actually a place where you can find silence. So its value is not as a building, its value is that it's a place where you can have silence. And it's only in silence that you can actually understand who you are.
I found a huge amount of silence through this podcast just now.
Very healthy.
Is that because your sound system's collapsed? Well.
I just wanted to chime in because I've come up with a question, and you know, I really appreciate what you're saying about self-awareness and not listening to the media and the polarization we hear about everything being negative. It's always us and them, isn't it? It's the rich and the poor, the healthy, the unhealthy, and actually that doesn't really exist. But I guess a fear that I was sitting with in this silence is, if I do all of this work on myself, will it have an effect on the collective? If you think about, you know, Jung's classic collective unconscious, I do all this work on myself, but I'm still being peppered by the media. I'm still being brought up by my parents in a certain way, which gives me my scripts, and, you know, the environment puts me in a certain way. How do I, by doing these exercises, influence, you know, those people out there? Is that...
I think that you need to... The question's the wrong way around. You don't need to do anything about trying to control anybody else. So you just need to make sure you focus on what you can do yourself. The collective will happen automatically. So by putting out vibrations which are positive into the universe, you will attract greater levels of vibration, positive vibrations back. It's the law of vibration. It is an inevitability. We're not here to try and tell people what to do or change them by saying this is wrong, this is right. Right? We are there to do it. We will make the changes by changing ourselves first and then acting the right way ourselves. And that will become so transparent, because all our actions, even just having a podcast like this, right? All our actions, if they come from the right place, will have much, much more influence than anything else. And if you look at the things that are making the most changes, look at Captain Tom. Look at Captain Tom, right? He's not trying to change the world. but he's having a heck of an influence just by his actions. Yeah. So it's not, it's, and he's sending fantastically positive vibrations, and that's what's going to change it. I'll defer to Katie to add some more to this.
I think what you've said is true, and I think it is the law of vibration and also the law of attraction, because your thoughts become things. So everything that exists around us is existing because of somebody who's thought that into action. So whether that's a good thing that's been thought into action, or a bad thing, that has still been thought into action. So if we take, for instance, COVID-19, it shows us how interconnected we are. So something that's happened, which is negative, we're seeing over one side of the world, has deeply impacted every part of the world. So it shows how humanity is so connected. So if something like that, which we see as something negative, equally on the opposite side of that, something so positive could deeply impact the whole of humanity at the same time. So is it Gandhi that says, be the light that you wish to see in the world? I just totally agree with that. I think you can't control other people, but you can control yourself. And I do believe that the more good you put out, the pebble effect will happen in the other way that it's happened this, you know, with COVID-19. So it actually shows that even COVID-19 is an energy, as we are an energy. So it's almost part of us. And if we look at it from the other direction, that we are creating this energy, therefore we can create positivity, which reflects and helps other people. So there is so much to it. And I don't think that, I know it's very overwhelming with the amount of negativity that we're seeing, but if we choose, and it is our choice, how we directly respond to it and how and where we put our energy, because where we put our energy, everything flows into that, then we're channeling that positive energy, and therefore that will have its own reaction.
Yeah. I totally agree with that, and it's very, I suppose I'm sitting with my fear is, can I actually do it? Because I know I'm externally orientated. I, you know, I do my yoga, I do breathing exercises, you know, I'm sitting in my chair as a psychotherapist looking at my clients going, why can't I do what I'm suggesting you guys do? You know, I'm getting them to do their exercises, I'm pulling back from their stories about all this mental stuff up here and saying, come down, get into your body, work on this trauma. It's not about them, it's about you, it's about your boundaries, your capacities, what you can do as a person. And then I walk out the room and do exactly what I shouldn't be doing.
Well, Alex, what you're saying is absolutely wonderful. It's wonderful in that actually you're opening your own door. You're opening your own door to awakening to who you really are as a person. It's a wonderful thing what you're doing. And sharing it is also, you know, an extremely good way. You are on the way. You are getting there. And well, I think just answer these two questions to yourself. Not now, but just spend a bit of time. Which is, first one is, who am I, and who are you? And then that will require you to meditate on that and to think about that. And the second question I'd ask you to think about is what's the end game? In other words, what's the whole purpose of your existence or the existence of a world? What's the point? What's the point of it? And I think if you spend a little bit of time quietly in silence thinking about that and then observing how you think about those, you will find gradually that you'll see something very, very different from what you're seeing now. And it will make that difference between what you observe in some of your clients and how you can be very different. And you will find that once you're in a different, it's different world, everything changes. You know, when we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. That's a Wayne Dyer quote. When we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. And it's very true. So Suzuki was asked, you know, what happens when I find this state? What's the difference between that and my everyday life? And he says, there's no difference between what I do. It's just that I'm several inches off the ground.
I enjoyed that. Vernon, Katie, I'm conscious of time, but I'm really enjoying this. And there was something that I wanted to get onto, and it was on love. And one of the bits I enjoyed, and not necessarily about mental health, but I think it's one of the important points that comes out, is the difference you give to positive, selfless love and then ego-based love. And I was just wondering if you could quickly summarize what the differences are and why that difference is so important.
Well, shall I start? I mean, I'll hand over to Katie. I mean, in the first book, actually, in The Stairway to Happiness, you'll see that I describe love. We have one word for love in English, but in Greek there are 8 or 9 different versions, including agape. And because actually there are so many different interpretations, from the erotic love at one end to the very spiritual love at another, and yet we in English only have one word. The issue for most of us is that love is seen in the context of duality. In other words, love is an attachment. It's an emotional attachment is the way Western society sees love, and indeed Eastern society. So love is very, very close to hate in that context. So you love somebody one minute and then you hate them the next minute because they've done something different. And then you love them again and then, oh no, it's all fallen apart, you hate them again. That isn't love. That is an emotional attachment. It's an egoic attachment. The irony or the shame is that actually that love does give you a glimpse of nirvana, because when you're really at the start of a nice love affair, you only think of the other person and you only want to do what's best for the other person. That is a glimpse of what nirvana can be. That is the glimpse of it. Unfortunately, it falls apart because we get selfish about it, or we get resentful, or we get jealous, or all those things make it back into duality. So the net result is it's not really love, because it's too dual. It's good and bad at the same time. The way to test it is, if you have a relationship of true love, you should be able to say to the other person, and they should be able to say the same to you, I love you unconditionally. And my whole heart is devoted to your well-being and your happiness. And if that means that you feel, or I feel at any time, but that means we should actually live apart, then that's what we should do. Now, that's really, really tough. It's a very tough proposition. But when we ask people, we say, you know, you ask somebody, you say, do you love me? Right? That's a terrible question to ask, because you're putting them in a terrible spot. And they'll say, oh, yes, of course I do. Yes, of course I could. Actually, the best answer is, I can't help but love you. I can't help but love you. In other words, there's no forcing. It's something I feel deeply, 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 rather than a coercion, I must, or I'm jealous, or whatever, right? Now, when we come into oneness, the oneness of love is getting closer to that last. The oneness of love is this unconditional love for the universe. There is nothing else that matters. And this is what's quite difficult for people, because, and in fact, I had a conversation with somebody today, and I said, you have to, because they were complaining about Trump and this and that. And I said, you have to have compassion for everybody. And they say, how can I have compassion? Because, you know, because they're doing so many wrong things. So, well, if you have love for the universe, you will have love for that person. They're doing what they think is best for them at that particular point in time. You feel compassion for them. And then whatever you have in something in your power, like voting or something, do that. But there's no point getting angry about it. Yeah. So the difference is between dual and oneness. But I'm sorry, but Katie, you go ahead.
I think you said it. Yeah, it's all about heart-centered leadership. When you lead from love, it creates a very different conversation, because it's not I'm trying to get anything out of the person I'm having a conversation with. It just, I'm leading with love, and I want you to have a good experience from this conversation as much as I do. So it's loving without conditions, and it's, like you said, universal love. And having love for all beings. And I think being able to see, because we're all the same, essentially, and we're all going through the same things, and having compassion for other people during this time helps other people to respond to you. So, yeah, loving without conditions, and just being in your own virtue and honesty and values helps other people to manifest that too in their lives. So, yeah, that's my concept of love.
That was an even better answer than I could bargain for, actually, on the topics of love. It's not something I'd usually ask, but I think you've got a very, very relevant, especially now, take on it.
Yeah, it was important. I think if people pick up one thing, I can't help but love you is a great way of getting into the good books with a girlfriend, boyfriend, I imagine. So
well, really actually, you should say that to the universe. In other words, when we're complaining about something, anything that's happening, say, I can't help but love the universe. Because remember, love is just another concept of God. I mean, it's universal intelligence, it's universal love. It underpins everything. It underpins absolutely everything. It's the foundation of every good thing. So it's not some sort of, you know, airy-fairy stuff. It is actually the foundation rock of everything.
No, that's brilliant. We could talk forever and ever about these different concepts, and it really is quite enlightening. But we do like to do a quick fire round where we put you on the spot and ask you some pretty relevant topical questions that you don't have too long to answer. There's no need for too much detail, but it's really the first thing that comes to mind. And my first one, which is very topical, is what your top tip would be to someone trying to deal with lockdown and quarantine and not being able to get out of the house?
Well, the top tip would be
one.
Accept what is. That means accept that it is happening. Because if you want to create stress, be in conflict with what is. It means I don't accept what's happening. Therefore, by definition, I'm going to be in stress. Accept it and then look positively at what you can do about it.
Perfect. Good. And Katie? You can't pick the same one now, unfortunately.
I know. That's unfair. Yeah.
She can go first next. It's all right.
Yeah, you go first next.
I would use this time, because we're never going to experience, well, I don't know, but it's a rare experience to experience this again. So value this time of stopping and really do look at maybe where your values are and what you're putting your values into, but use this time for yourself. Like, really do the work on yourself, because, like I said, as soon as we get into this busy rat race again, we'll wish that we had this time back again.
You're right.
Yeah. Perfect. I keep playing that game actually with some friends. You know, when you hear
that's
them
a good answer,
complain,
it's really good.
Yeah, it's really good because you do hear people complain, and then you go, okay, but if I told you you're going to be back at work and it's going to be completely normal by the end of next week, what's your first thought? And yeah, I know that my brain just rushes to go, I'm not ready. I want another 3 weeks on the sofa. But I want to know that it's only 3 weeks. And that's our natural, as you said, you know, our brains go straight for what's the certainty that I know? And why, you know, we can't deal with the uncertainty of it, but it's so true, Katie, obviously, you know, to hear
people
to work on themselves, but it's such an opportunity to just reflect.
Yeah, I think it would be a sad time if we came out of this and we didn't grow or evolve as a human species collectively. That would be a very sad time. So I think we've all got to play our part in this. We've all got to do the work.
That's good. And moving on to the next one, this one's specifically for Vernon. I've got one for Katie afterwards, so you don't have to think of different answers. Vernon, your top tip for dealing with anxiety and stress, if you had to pick one?
Live in the now. Learn to live now.
Okay.
Which means learn to enjoy with enthusiasm everything that you're doing. So whatever it is, even if it's washing up, do it with enthusiasm. Do it with determination. When you walk across the floor, be aware of your connection to the floor. If you're talking to somebody, give them 100% attention. You'll find that if you do things like that, being in the now, it will crowd out, it will stop these anxieties from coming into your mind. And you can handle anything there. I mean, in the book, there's, but you probably see there was an anecdote when I got stuck for an hour and a half in Orlando Airport.
Yes.
That time went so fast, just being in the now.
Yeah.
It wasn't difficult. And the end result was a wonderful exchange with, what was his name, Officer Hernandez at the other end, who couldn't believe that somebody was actually smiling, positive.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't that difficult. But it's worth practicing. It's worth practicing that.
Okay, good. And Katie, your one, it's something we actually get asked a lot and people, I think, really struggle with. And the way I see it, there are a lot of people who are very, very good on one side, very, very good with meditation, and they're well into it and they know how to practice it. And then there are a load of others who are really keen to start, but just can't quite find the right way into it. And my question for you is, what would you say to someone who knows that it will really help them, but is struggling just with that first step of getting into meditation?
I think you need to set an intention for yourself. So to say that if you say, for me, I do a good 45 minutes to an hour, but that's not for everybody. So your intention is to do 10 minutes, that's fine, or 5 minutes, that's fine, but make sure you do it. And then it starts to become a repetitive pattern. Yeah. It starts to reprogram your mind and establish a new habit. So, but keep doing it, keep going back to it. And the more that you keep doing it, without overthinking it, it's not about overthinking, but it's letting go. But it's just being completely just where you are. Try not to think. I know try not to think about anything is easier said than done. But the more you practice it, the more it becomes second nature.
Yeah.
So just giving yourself that intention and making sure that you do that intention, so re-establish a new habit.
Perfect. And my final question is quotes, because I think one thing that your book does really well is it doesn't just overload on quotes that are so relevant and right for us to hear, but it picks out some really, really interesting ones. I mean, my favorite one actually isn't a quote from someone else, but I wanted to read it because it really, I don't know why it resonated so much with me, but it just really made me think, and I've been thinking about it ever since. And it's, "The reason the Buddha is often pictured with a smile on his face is that he is mildly by the totally unnecessary suffering that we inflict on ourselves by the self-importance that we project." And I'm still trying to work it out. I need to write it down and read through it, because for me, that is so much in a nutshell, and I absolutely loved it. So my question for you two, and Vernon maybe first, is of all the quotes in the book, of everything that you've ever read, which one for you sort of resonates the most?
Well, I mean, the one which it resonates the most for me is from Albert Einstein, which is that he says that the scientist's spiritual feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared to it, all the systematic thinking and acting of a human being is an utterly irrelevant reflection. This feeling is the driving force of his life and work, insofar as he succeeds in unlocking himself from the shackles of selfish desire. It is without question akin to that which pervade the religious sages of all time.
I'm impressed you can remember that off by heart as well.
I hope you've got a cheat sheet, because otherwise I'm going to be very upset.
I haven't. But if you ask me which was the most important,
yeah.
And I mean, I've got lots, but this to me, he, a scientist, left-brained mathematics specialist, right, got very upset when people said to him, "You're a brilliant scientist." He said, "No. The reason I've discovered these things is because I've got depth. I'm the ocean. I'm not the stuff at the top. And it's my spiritual side which has enabled me to understand things, not my mathematical ability. It's not the intellectual side, it's the spiritual side." And that is the essence of a book. So for me, there are lots of quotes. We liked all of them. But that to me is one I keep with me all the time because it's part of who I'm trying to become.
There's a fascinating book called Quantum Questions by Ken Wilber, which goes into a lot of those details. A lot of the famous scientists like Einstein basically he's saying that they are mystics and that they weren't just scientists in inverted commas, they were people.
Well, absolutely. Max Planck, you see, of a Planck, Max Planck Institute in Germany said exactly the same thing. And you're right, the more advanced scientists, we can talk about quantum physics maybe another time, but the more quantum physics happens, the more it's actually proving that all the mystical ideas which we've put in, I mean, the universal laws are ancient, ancient laws. You know, the Tao Te Ching was written 500 years BC. I mean, all these were ideas and people rubbish them, but actually quantum physics is showing that they're actually correct. Right? They are absolutely right. So physics is coming, as Katie was saying earlier, physics is coming together with spirituality and is actually proving things which for a long time people said, oh, no, I can't prove it, so it can't exist. Whereas in fact, those most important things are the very things that do exist, even if they can't be proven at the time.
Was that a short enough answer for you, Kate?
That's unfortunately, that's not going to qualify for our quickfire round, Vernon, but I'm joking. Well, we will find a way to fit it in.
I could have said yes.
If all our guests answered yes to our yes or no to our questions, we wouldn't have much of a podcast. So I'm quite grateful that you don't. Katie, finally, your quote. And unfortunately, you've got the same problem. You're going second, so it means you can't take the same one.
Sorry, just quickly going back to what you were saying about the quantum field, even just us doing this now, it just shows this divine synchronicity. You know, so many people are experiencing this right now. And this thread that interconnects everyone. So, yeah, just even the fact that we're doing this right now is that coincidence. Absolutely. Or synchronicity.
It's also a reason that we're going way over the time. We can't stop. I don't want to stop, but I'm really looking forward to this last answer.
Okay, so my two quotes. Can I say two? Is that okay?
Of course you can, yes.
Of course.
The first one is Einstein. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting a different result.
Yeah.
Which we seem to be doing quite a lot. And then the other one is actually Jimi Hendrix's quote, which is, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace.
Love it. And it's actually a lovely point as well to end. I mean, Vernon, Katie, Alex, we could probably sit here and talk. Actually, I have no doubt we could sit here and talk for a very, very long time. The book is fantastic and I genuinely really enjoyed it. And I have a feeling that if everyone went away and read it, the world would be a slightly better place, if not a far better place. And to hear it from you guys personally is even more powerful. Thank you for taking the time. I think the next episode is going to be on quantum physics by the sounds of your final answers. Might get a bit heavy for our mental health podcast. But no, in all seriousness, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you all. And on behalf of Alexi and I, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
You're very welcome. Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Well, very grateful. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Mindfield Pod. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and get in touch. We all have our own minefields, and we hope that this podcast goes some way to helping you navigate yours.